Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm thrilled to have as my guest Susan Orlean. The book, most recently, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, you know, I usually do fiction and poetry, and I found myself reading Rin Tin Tin, maybe because I like The Orchid Thief so much, and I learned all kinds of things about this remarkable dog that I didn't think would be part of my life, and there is something incredibly endearing about this kind of reporting. Describe this kind of reporting. What is it?
That's a good question, because people often say, what do you call this? Is this narrative nonfiction? Is this, what is it? And I just say it's storytelling. What happens is I fall in love with an idea. And in this case, I had encountered a little bit of information about the real story of Rin Tin Tin, not the television character that I knew, but the real dog behind that character. And I just threw myself in it in every direction. I feel like it's truly throwing the net as wide as you possibly can, going in every direction, gathering, talking to people, reading archives, trying to distill a very big, diffuse story, and then be able to come to a reader and say, I just learned something so interesting. I've got to tell you. Sit down. Let me tell you the story of Rin Tin Tin. It starts, and then lure them back in time to a point that they never imagined that they would be exploring, in this case, starting really in the 1800s and then moving forward to the present.
Now, there are set pieces, it seems. My favorite of them in this book is you imagine having a picnic in the pet cemetery in Paris where Rin Tin Tin is said to be buried, but no one is quite sure. We know that the dog is no longer buried in California. Maybe he's buried there, but you begin to survey the names on the gravestones, and you notice that there are several Ulysseses, and you ask, are there dogs named Ulysses in America? Only the French. And before long, we're there with you at this non-picnic. You haven't brought a basket, but you are strolling appetitively among the stones. Yes.
Well, I very much wanted to both go to where the real Rin Tin Tin had been born, which was on a battlefield in France, and then as my very last piece of reporting, symbolically for me, was to go to the cemetery where he is said to be buried. And, you know, among the many themes in the book is the idea of the passage of time, of memory, of essentially memorializing the things that we love, which, of course, is what a cemetery is, and the fact that maybe Rin Tin Tin really isn't buried there, but this marker that makes us feel that he's remembered is there. It was very thematically appropriate. And at the same time, I was sitting there, you know, having a kind of nice afternoon in a cemetery, which seemed really peculiar. And yet it was Paris. It was the summer. It was a very quiet place, and I was in a place full of memory and of little bits of culture.
I know that you worked on local newspapers, but the kind of reporting that you do, finding interesting people who've devoted their lives to the pursuit of an ideal, whether it's a ghost orchid, where did that start? When did you start?
My first writing job was at a tiny little magazine in Portland, Oregon. I had no idea how you wrote a story or how you even conceived of a story, frankly. But at that point, I had become a very avid New Yorker reader. As a kid, I read Life magazine, which at that time did a lot of these slice of life stories. They were really, there was a famous one that I just remember so vividly from my childhood. It was basically 24 hours in the life of a country doctor who did everything from deliver babies to, you know, write out death certificates, everything in this small town. I think as a kid, I was really struck by the idea that this is a kind of story you could tell. It doesn't have to be a news story. It could just be, look at the life that someone else leads, that is a life that I myself don't inhabit, but also maybe most people don't inhabit, and maybe examine it and see the way those aspirations to doing something well or becoming obsessed, those are universal. But the particulars of a life become exotic, even if it's someone as ordinary as the guy who runs the grocery store in your town. The idea that once you go in that life, it becomes enormous and mysterious, because it is. It's as mysterious as going to a strange land. And I think it innately connected for me, so that the minute I was given the freedom to come up with story ideas, those were the kinds of stories I was coming up with. It was very nervy. I'm glad that I had the confidence or the sheer sort of oblivion of youth to think that this was a job. I cannot imagine another version of my professional life that would be more marvelous. I feel I have the freedom to do those stories that aren't the high concept, you know, 2-minute elevator pitch kind of story, because they're all about a quieter kind of penetration into worlds.
So you bring the idea to the New Yorker,
mm-hmm.
and they say?
They usually take a very deep breath and say, I have no idea what it is that you're aiming for, but, you know, you have our blessing. And I've been really incredibly fortunate to have their confidence that these stories that usually begin, you know, sometimes it's just a word, taxidermy, you know, and I just think taxidermy, there's got to be a great story there. And the fact is that you sometimes need just to go out and dig around and find the story and have the story alone can sometimes be the curiosity to learn about a subculture. And not a lot of publications are comfortable with that very simple idea, which is it's worth exploring a subculture. And I can't think of a time when the New Yorker said to me, no, we're not interested in X. I mean, there have been times when a story didn't work for other reasons, but it has never been where they said, you know, we don't really care about taxidermy, trailer parks, Midland, Texas, you know, any of the cockamamie ideas that I've come up with. I've never had that reaction, as much as not sure what the story is, what are you planning to do? And many times my answer to that is, I don't know, I have to go find out. I can't tell you what the story is until I go experience it. And I've had that freedom to go, and who knows what I'm going to find. And that's just, it's really great. I would knock on wood, except it would make too much noise on the radio.
Well, I'm talking to Susan Orlean. The occasion is her book on Rin Tin Tin, and this is one of the book-length pieces that you've done, I think entirely independent of The New Yorker.
Yes, yes.
And as I understand it, you do all of your reporting before you begin to write. Now, that's amazing. How do you, are you always thinking, where am I going to begin this? Where is the...
Yeah. That's the agony of doing it that way, which is the entire time I'm reporting, I'm thinking, I have no idea how I'm going to tell this story. What am I doing? Why did I just spend this amount of time doing this reporting? Am I even going to use it in the book? But I feel like I don't know the story until I'm done learning it. It would be like writing my college graduation speech before I graduated from college.
I felt that when I had gotten to the end of Rin Tin Tin, that I'd read a different book than the one you thought you were going to write at the beginning. And what the difference for me is that I think that what emerges from your writing, you'll pardon me for being presumptuous, is your sweet nature. Do you have a sweet nature? Because, you see, I get to the end of Rin Tin Tin, and I'm saying, just as I thought, Hollywood, full of dreamers at the beginning and grifters at the end. You know, that's the way it goes, you know, and this is the downfall of American popular entertainment. Instead, Susan Orlean's book is, I love the dream of Rin Tin Tin, and I love all of the people after who are trying to activate the dream, even if it turns out that they are no part of it, like a person who turns up and pretends to be the little boy who was in the adventures of Rin Tin Tin show, and the odd surprises that come when you see the silent films and you see that, unbeknownst to anyone, it was beautiful where the North begins, you know, a beautiful and stark piece of work, that it had its art even at the level of the serializations. I found it, like, lovely that you as a writer, don't surrender the ideal of Rin Tin Tin.
And that's a really interesting and probably one of the most, I think, encapsulates, I think, what even at arm's length I can imagine that the book seems like. Because I went into it, not all I knew was this was an amazing story. Here we are, almost 100 years after some puppy was born, and people still remember his name and think about him, and in many cases have lawsuits about him. And, you know, that this has sort of continued on. And every part of it ultimately filled me with something that was a kind of poignant affection for, and also a sort of wistfulness. At the heart of it, it was just this simple, simple thing of a boy and a dog and the perfection of their connection and the sort of crazy Hollywoodization of this very simple, very beautiful relationship, which, you know, even at the worst of it, I find a kind of, there's something funny about our fumbling as a species toward an effort to feel some meaning in our lives. And that can be kind of comic. It can sometimes be messy. It can be very clumsy. But it ultimately, you can't help but feel like we're such these tiny little creatures on this big blue ball, trying to just stumble and fumble our way toward feeling that life means something.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking to Susan Orlean, wonderful reporter, writes regularly for The New Yorker. We're here in the studios of KCRW. We're talking about her newest book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, and we'll continue after this short break.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. I'm talking with Susan Orlean about Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, which traces the journey of a puppy from a World War I battlefield through movie and television superstardom and onto iconic marketing branding. It's quite an arc, and for you and your family, too. You begin with glinting a miniature Rinty on your grandfather's shelf collection of toys. Tell about him.
This was my grandfather, who was not a very cuddly man at all, and the idea that he even had toys is some bit of cognitive dissonance, knowing his character. But he had various toys on his desk, but he had a Rin Tin Tin figurine. He let us play with the other toys. We were never allowed to touch this Rin Tin Tin. So from a very early point in my memory, this was the unattainable. And of course, as a result, we wanted it more than anything else, that being allowed to play with these other toys, with the Elmer Fudd and the other toys he had on his desk, meant nothing, because what we wanted was this Rin Tin Tin. Plus, we really loved Rin Tin Tin. We didn't have a dog when I was growing up, so my brother and sister and I had a passion for Rin Tin Tin that was even greater, because this was, in truth, the unattainable. That figurine came to a very sad end, which I wrote about in the book. And spoiler alert, I don't know that this really changes the reading of the book, but finally, I don't know how or why, he allowed us, my grandfather allowed us once to play with the Rin Tin Tin and to take it home for the evening. And we were so excited that we were grabbing it from each other, and of course, we broke it. We returned it to him the next day with the broken leg. It was, you know, as I said, my grandfather was not the kind of grandfather who would say, oh, kids, don't worry, no problem. Wordlessly put this broken figurine in a desk drawer or desk cabinet, shut it. That was it. We never saw it again. We could never discuss it again. When I was first reminded of Rin Tin Tin, where I came across his name most unexpectedly in the course of working on another New Yorker piece, what I first thought of was how much I had loved Rin Tin Tin when I was a kid. And then secondly, almost in the same exact moment, I thought, why did my grandfather have that figurine? I mean, he was way too old to be watching the TV show. And why was he so protective of it?
The opening of the Rin Tin Tin show was a matter of some debate and discussion amongst the producers on various levels, down to Burt Leonard,
the producer of the show.
And can you close your eyes and paint us a picture of what you see when the show begins?
It begins with a bugle, a little bugle phrase, and then this orchestra sort of surges, a song that I think everybody of a certain age kind of sits up straight because they remember it so well. The setting is, it's supposed to be Arizona in the 1870s, when Arizona was still a territory. And there's an army fort with a stockade fence. And as this music is swelling, the doors open and the cavalry rides in on these beautiful horses, and they're in their navy blue cavalry uniforms, first led by Rip Masters, very handsome dark-haired, classically good-looking guy. This James Brown was his name. And he is reviewing the troops. And the foot soldiers come running in and line up. And then who comes scrambling but this little boy who in the show is meant to be about, say, 9 or 10. And he's got a sort of bit of a doughy face, and he's wearing that cavalry hat that's got the flipped up front. He comes running in, followed by this big, gorgeous German shepherd. So they're absurd in this lineup of soldiers. They squeeze in and they're saluting as this sergeant is reviewing the troops. And there's the little boy and the dog sitting at attention. And it's a classic. It really was a classic opening of a television show. And they spent a great deal of time figuring out what this opening would be. And I think shows don't open the way they did back then with the opening. They tend to open in the middle of the action and then do credits and so forth after a few minutes.
I miss theme songs. I want theme songs back. I love jingles. I wish they would come back.
Well, they became big hits.
Yes.
You know, people were so... And that's a song which I won't frighten you by trying to sing it.
Please do.
It's like, do, 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 do. I can't do it very well, but it's this sort of military march and... It wasn't a vocal. It was this sort of orchestral, kind of military marching song, and it was it's just a classic opening. And they spent a huge amount of time. I found very funny memos between Screen Gems and Burt Leonard, the producer, sort of fighting about what that opening would be like because they knew how important it was, and everything from the music to what the little boy was going to be named. You know, this was
Rusty,
all...
Dusty.
Yeah, Johnny. They were changing the name a million times till they finally settled on Rusty. And the most important thing that they argued about, in, I thought, hilarious detail, was what the catchphrase would be. Because you had the Lone Ranger who would say, "Hi-ho, Silver," and away. And it was something kids said. It became very... very much a meme in the 1950s sense of a meme. There was a lot of argument. Should he say, "Get him, Rinty," or "Go get him, Rinty," or "Fight him, Rinty"? And, you know, to see the memos back and forth on this, it was hilarious. He ended up finally with "Yo, Rinty," which, as I started working on the book, there were... many, many times where people would say to me, "What are you working on?" And I'd say, "Well, I'm doing a book about Rin Tin Tin." And I would say 6 times out of 10, if I was saying it to a man of a certain age, he would immediately say, "Yo, Rinnie!"
And it's a kind of lovely thing to think of this man, Lee Duncan,
mm-hmm.
who's, you know, he knows... the little dolls that the French soldiers wear. One is mm-hmm. named Rin Tin Tin, it's a boy, and one is named Nanette, it's a girl. And they are the only survivors of a battle, and therefore they have dolls dedicated to them, so that when he's on the battlefield and he finds a puppy, a perfect puppy, and he rescues it and several others and names them Rin Tin Tin and Nanette, and from there on, a huge cultural history cascades down that includes the history of dog training in America, the history of dogs on battlefields, and all of it taken up by Susan Orlean to create this book much larger than the figure of its hero, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. Now, tell me, what are some of the things that you're thinking about? Where is your eye being cast? Where are we going with you next?
Yes. Well, I find, even though I have thought to myself I should take a little break, I worked on this book for such a long time, I think it's just part of who I am. I always get excited about something new. In fact, yesterday somebody was mentioning something totally casually about the issue of Buddhist nuns wanting to be ordained and how there's this great conflict and fight going on in the Buddhist religion about whether it should happen. And I thought, that's an amazing story. What's it like to be a Buddhist nun? And then this morning somebody sent me a picture he thought he'd like because he knows that I like mules. And it was about these mules in Venezuela that deliver, they act as libraries, and they walk from town to town with, you know, 50 or 100 books strapped on their back, and they are the lending library in these little mountain villages in Venezuela. And I thought, oh, that's an amazing story. So I'm in the process now of gathering these millions of ideas, some of which will be the size of a New Yorker story, which is a, you know, nice, comfy size, but a very specific start and end point. And then a few that I sense could grow to be bigger and could be, I don't think the Mule Library is a book, but I think there's always that feeling that I'll have, this is a great story, and then ever so often, once every, say, 8 years, one where I think, that's big. That's a big story. With Rin Tin Tin, I immediately knew that it wasn't a magazine piece. I just thought, this is big. I know it is. It's so much time. The little I knew immediately made me think, there's something really rich here. I've had a lot of people tell me, not as a complaint, but almost as a compliment, that they cried a lot in the course of reading the book. And I think, you know, the idea that you can bring an emotional story alive for people is very gratifying, because for me it was very emotional.
I've been talking with Susan Orlean, author most recently of Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, absolutely.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Alan Howard. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
So brave is Corporal Rusty, though he is just a boy.
Just a boy.
How true is Private Rin Tin Tin? They are the Army's pride and joy.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm.
You're ready, pals through thick and thin.
From all the tales of the West, we'll remember best
Corporal Rusty
and Private Rin Tin Tin.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Sace Notterbaum is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.